Я думаю, что мы можем считать нашу школу открытой. И начнем мы с того, что заслушаем лекцию нашего уважаемого гостя. Так что передаем ему слово.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Sophia, Alexandra, and thank you everybody for coming. I apologize that I do not speak Russian. I would love to speak it. It's a beautiful language, but I don't. I think in my life I'm not sure I will find time to learn Russian. This is my third visit to Moscow. The very first time I was here was for the World Congress of 1993, and that was a very exciting event. It was the first time that philosophers, international philosophers, had come to Russia for many, many years. And many important people visited. I remember being at the table with Richard Rorty, for example, and other philosophers. And then the last time I was here was for the World Philosophy Day in 2009, and we listened to Habermas. There was a famous event at that talk, where some student, or I think, attacked somebody else. So it was very dramatic, and it was in the newspapers, but nothing about Habermas's talk on, which was on, I think, was on tolerance. Today I'm going to talk about the self in Husserl's phenomenology, and I'm going to try to explicate the theme of the self, which is everywhere in Husserl. Towards the end of the Cartesian Meditations, Husserl writes, "The Delphic motto, 'Know thyself, gnotis auton,' has gained a new signification. Positive science is a science lost in the world. I must lose the world in the epoche in order to regain it by universal self-examination, selbstbesinnung. Do not go outside," says Augustine. "Truth dwells in the interior, in you, in the interior man." So this was towards the end of the Cartesian Meditations. Husserl places an emphasis on the old Socratic tradition of knowing yourself, gnotis auton. So what is it for Husserl to know oneself? Well, first of all, Husserl regards phenomenology as Selbsterfahrung, as the experience of oneself, of self-experience. We know that he had a very strong interest in the Cartesian conception of philosophy and of the self. Indeed, in the Cartesian Meditations, he refers to his philosophy as a new Cartesianism. And in the same text, he says that phenomenology is a science of subjectivity. And indeed, he calls it also an egology, the logos of the ego. I will show you in the course of this lecture what are the influences here on Husserl. He was strongly influenced by the modern philosophical tradition, beginning with Descartes, whom he thought of as the first transcendental philosopher, Kant, Fichte, and Brentano, his teacher, and then Natorp, the neo-Kantian, Paul Natorp, who was a good friend of his. Quite surprisingly, in the middle of one of his texts, the Ideen, Husserl refers to this Cartesian philosopher called Hillings, who was a Belgian philosopher and an occasionalist in the spirit of Malebranche and Leibniz. And Hillings had this idea of knowledge of oneself directly. He claimed that we did not know our bodies, we only know ourselves, our consciousnesses, directly. He was very like Berkeley in this regard. But he's a very unusual philosopher, but from him comes this term inspectio sui, that is self-inspection, which is taken up by Husserl. Husserl has many terms for talking about this explication of the self. He uses the terms Selbsterkenntnis, self-knowledge, Selbstbesinnung, self-meditation or self-examination, Selbsterfahrung, self-experience, we already heard, to which he always opposes the experience of others, Fremderfahrung. But he uses terms like Selbstapprehension, apperception, which is a kind of Cartesian or a Kantian idea. But he also talks about the explication of the self, one's self-oneness, Selbsteigenheit, and he speaks in the Cartesian meditations of the I in my ownness or in my Eigenheitssphäre, sometimes he says, the I in my sphere of ownness, my I in its own self-enclosed world. And of course, for Husserl, the whole aim of philosophy is to be a self-thinker, to be able to think for oneself. And he connected that with the idea of Selbstverantwortung, responsibility to oneself, answerability to oneself. So these terms go right the way through the Husserlian phenomenology. And right from the beginning, Husserl has a contrast that he takes from Fichte between all experiences that I can take as mine, ich, and those which are not me, nicht ich. And he goes quite deep into the consciousness of subjectivity. There are things I experience within my own consciousness which are not me. He will give the example of a pain or a headache. When you have a headache, of course it's deep within your own consciousness, but it's almost like it's something outside invading you rather than part of your self-experience. So Husserl wants to explore very closely the boundaries of self and non-self, of what is ich-nähe, which is near to the self, and what is ich-fremd, what is foreign to the self. Now, with the notion of the ego comes also the notion of the epoche, and this capacity we have to be able to take a stance towards our own thinking. This requires me being able to split myself, and Husserl talks about this ego-splitting, ich-spaltung, through which I'm able to take a look at myself from another point of view. I'll explain this as we go along. And he also thinks that this ego splitting, this capacity to look at myself from another side of myself, is the basis for my understanding others. Other egos, the alter ego. Ultimately, Husserl's phenomenology aims at a much wider philosophy of spirit, Geist, and he speaks about the interconnection and interpenetration of different cogitos or different selves. He speaks about this as an in ein Andersein, a term that Merleau-Ponty will take up, l'interla, the interconnection or interlacing between different minds. So that in one text, Husserl even speaks about the correct form of the cogito of Descartes is not ego cogito, but nos cogitamus, we think, because all of us experience ourselves as belonging to what he calls here a wir Gemeinschaft, a we society, a we community. So we belong to, and Husserl, and we know this now, there's a lot of interest in social and collective intentionality. But Husserl was the first really to explore this idea where we can have joint intentions. We can make communal agreements and intentions that go beyond the individual self. But Husserl also recognizes the priority of the ego. So he says, for example, well, he doesn't say, but it's something you could that he could say, only an I can say we. In other words, even the basis of the we is already the individual ego. Scalings. Now, Husserl has a very rich account in his phenomenology of different levels or layers, Stufe, of the ego. Right? He speaks, especially in the Crisis manuscripts, of das Ur-Ich, a kind of primitive or original ego, which is very deep down. For him, there is no consciousness which is not ego-centered. For Husserl rejects the possibility of a consciousness that does not have an ego at the center of it. So he thinks even at the most primitive layer of awareness, perhaps you could imagine the baby in the womb or some very primitive level of conscious awareness, there's already what Husserl calls an Ur-Ich, which links together our experiences that are linked by what he calls passive association. But this ego already, for Husserl, has triebe, drives, and instincta, instincts, as well as, of course, and something Husserl is very concerned about, an initial deep time awareness. Husserl in the Cartesian meditation says that the most deep layer of the human self is the temporal awareness. And rather like in Merleau-Ponty, for Husserl, there is already at the level of just basic activities what you might call a pre-reflective vor-predicativa knowledge of the self. We have a direct awareness of ourselves in our intentional acts. Not just in our acts, but also in our passive experiences. And Husserl has a lot to say on what he calls the habitualities of the ego, habitus. It's a concept that's taken up later in sociology. But Husserl talks a great deal about how we sediment activities until they become attributes of the ego. But Husserl thinks at the very top level, there are peculiarly egoic acts, ich-achte. These are acts of the personal self. Rather like in Sartre, these are acts where I make myself through decisions. You know, I decide I will become a vegetarian, or I decide I will no longer sleep late in the day or something. These decisions that I make are acts that I am committed to through my ego. And for Husserl, these are the most important acts of the human being. They are acts in which I take responsibility for myself. And they are also the basis of the collective and social acts that he later talks about. But then, and this is going to bring us now to the more directly to the theme of transcendental phenomenology, Husserl thinks that really one of the great breakthroughs in Western philosophy was Descartes' doubt and his realization that the ego can never be removed. So the discovery of the ego at the very basis of our experience is for Husserl the first transcendental move. And for him it's a breakthrough to a new style of living, because now we can live in a world of what he calls reflective self-awareness. This is the discovery of the transcendental ego, and Husserl even speaks about transcendental life. So he has an idea of the possibility of living, as a philosopher, a purely self-reflective transcendental life, where we have uncovered all the motivations and processes that go into our decisive egoic acts. So in his mature thought, he distinguishes between two kinds of living: natural living in the world, as what he calls a Weltkind, a child of the world. And Husserl has several phrases he uses a lot. As you all know, phenomenology is the study of lived experiences, Erlebnisse. And Erlebnisse means things that we directly encounter in our personal experience. The word Leben is connected there. And Husserl often uses the phrase Leben ist Erleben. To live is to experience. The flow of life is a flow of experiences. He also says Leben ist Streben. To live is to strive. So he has the idea of an active egoic striving of ourselves in the world. But the initial, and as we saw in the first slide, in this original living in the world, we are living in a way naturally that is outward directedly. So we are not aware of ourselves. It requires an act of what he calls the epoche, or bracketing, that allows me to step back from my involvements in the world and to come to an experience of myself, to subtract, if you like, myself from the world. And Husserl says very clearly that when we do this, we arrive at a new conception of the ego, which has left behind everything human, the normal human personality. Our normal human consciousness belongs within the natural world. The transcendental ego is a much more strange kind of thing because it doesn't have that same character. But this becomes complex in Husserl. Husserl thinks that there is a parallel between the life of the engaged natural ego and the life of the transcendental ego. And indeed he speaks about, as you see there, a strict parallelism between the transcendental ego and the natural ego. But he also talks about the transcendental ego, which is for him the source, he says, of all Sinn und Sein, of all meaning and being. This ego, transcendental ego, which is, if you like, the opening through which we understand everything in the world and which filters everything in the world for us, is also embodied in the world. Husserl talks about Vermenschlichung of des Ego, the humanization of the ego, or Mundanisierung or Verweltlichung des Ichs, the mundanization or the enworlding of the I. This, by the way, this theme is taken up very strongly in Merleau-Ponty with the notion of the incarnation, of the incarnation of the self in the world, deliberately taking over this theological theme, but now doing it within the realm of transcendental philosophy. Now, this is Husserl, when he talks in Ideen, Ideen 1, 1913, about the natural human ego. He talks about a kind of natural living in the world. In the course of observing something, I perceive it. Likewise, in remembering, I'm often preoccupied with something. In fictionalizing fantasy, I closely follow goings on in the imagined world, in a quasi-observation of them. Or I reflect, I draw inferences, I retract a judgment, occasionally refraining from judgment altogether. I consummate a state of being pleased or displeased. I am joyful or sad. I wish or I want or act. I also refrain from joy, from the wish, willing and acting. In all such acts, I am there with them, concurrently with them. In reflecting, I construe myself as a human being with them. So this is something that Husserl points to very clearly, and I think phenomenology has been very helpful in showing the full range of the experiences in the flow of our consciousness. Joy, sadness, wishing, refraining, bracketing, but also reflecting. So Husserl distinguishes between the natural reflection of the ego in the natural world, when I reflect upon myself as a human being, and what he talks about later as a kind of transcendental reflection. But this natural living, he often describes as not really being self-directed. It's directed away from oneself. Every experiencing or other kind of directedness towards the mental takes place in the mode of reflection. To live as ego subject is to live through the mental in multiple ways. But this, our live-through life, is, to so to speak, anonymous. It goes on, but we're not focused on it. It is unexperienced, since to experience something amounts to grasping something in its selfhood. Perceiving means we are occupied with only the perceived windmill. We are focused on it and only on it. This is the idea that in our intentional experience we are focused outwards. And, if you like, our life in the world is really not self-centered. It's only, as he says, through reflection, turning one's gaze away from the straightforwardly thematic, which makes mental life itself, the highly diverse ways of having something as a theme, being occupied with, being conscious, with all their peculiarities and possible backgrounds, the object of thematic gaze. So there's a special kind of abstracting reflection that makes possible coming to awareness of this ego. And what is involved in this, as he always says, is an abstention from Stellung nehmen, from position taking. According to the earlier assertion, a mere reflection as consciousness does not yet yield in the mental in its purity and its own essence. Rather, we must, in addition, abstain from Seinsglaubens, belief in being, by virtue of which we accept the world in the natural life of consciousness and are reflecting on it. As phenomenologists, we are not permitted to go along with this. As phenomenologists, we must be, as it were, non-participating onlookers at the life of consciousness. So Husserl recognizes this peculiar capacity of human beings, not just to have within their natural life the power of reflecting on episodes or periods, or particularly episodes of consciousness, but also, if you like, a kind of disciplined abstraction from our experience, whereby we become what he calls non-participating onlookers at the life of consciousness. Incidentally, Husserl thought that this capacity to become a non-participating onlooker on one's own life was the original breakthrough of Greek philosophy. He puts this to be the discovery of the life of theoria, and therefore gave the possibility of the objective stance of the sciences. So this capacity of human beings to take this stance, this non-participating onlooker stance, is really very, very important. It's a huge step forward for human nature. He doesn't think all cultures have broken through. This is the great, he calls it Durchbruch or Einbruch into transcendental life. And this, as I said before, leads to a certain suspension of everything human. If I carry out the phenomenological epoche, if the ego, the human being, along with the entire world, as it is naturally supposed, is suspended, then the unadulterated experience of the act with its own essence still remains. So Husserl has a very strong belief in the capacity of the epoche to peel back the layers of what is human and to allow us to have an experience of the pure transcendental subject. Of course, this is precisely what was challenged by Merleau-Ponty in the Phenomenology of Perception, and indeed by Heidegger in his concept of Dasein. So Husserl in the Cartesian Meditations says that the epoche can also be said to be the radical and universal method by which I apprehend myself purely as ego with my own conscious life. So for Husserl, it really is important that the epoche is not just some part of the phenomenological method. It is the only way that I can gain access to the activity of the ego in itself. So, and this ego, as he says, Descartes, as we know, indicated all that by the name cogito. The world is for me absolutely nothing else but the world existing for and accepted by me in such a conscious cogito. The world gets its whole sense, Sinn, universal and specific, and its acceptance, its Seinsglaube, its acceptance as existing exclusively from such cogitationes or thoughts. So this is Husserl at his most transcendental. He actually understands, he thinks all philosophy has to take this transcendental step. As he says that it is only the transcendental epoche and the reduction that releases transcendental subjectivity from its self-concealment, Selbstverborgenheit, and raises up to a new position, that of transcendental self-consciousness. And Husserl has this demand that philosophy, once it breaks through to the transcendental attitude, can never go back. It must remain, in some respect, living this parallel life that it is both, as he says in the Crisis, in the world and for the world. So although we are in the world, we are also somehow for the world. Now, I'll just say a little bit about the background to Husserl's development. Husserl didn't always hold this position about the ego. It is part of his mature philosophy, especially with Ideas 1 onwards, where he's already taking a strongly Cartesian position. Husserl began as a student of Brentano, and Brentano, as we know, was one of the founders of empirical psychology. And he was part of, Brentano was a great admirer of Hume and the empirical method. And like Hume, Brentano didn't feel we needed to talk about an ego. He, in fact, belonged to this tradition that's talked of psychologie ohne Psyche, psychology without the soul, a movement that sort of said that, in fact, it was the whole force of modern psychology is to move away from self-description to a kind of objective analysis of experiences. So in his early years, Husserl was very much a follower of Brentano, and I'll show this a little bit more. But somewhere around 1905, he began to read Kant, and he recognized this Kantian theme that the ego cogito, or the I think, must accompany all my representations, as Kant says. And Husserl quotes this, I'll show you this now. And part of the influence was through his friend, the Marburg neo-Kantian Paul Natorp, who was a classical scholar, but also wrote a number of Einleitungen, introductions into psychology. Now, for Natorp, the ego cannot be known directly. Why? Because the ego is the, if you like, the point of view. It's the subjective point of view. And therefore, it can never be a content of experience, since it is, if you like, the form of experience. This is a very Kantian position. So once we try to objectify this subjective point of view, we objectify it is to lose it. Rather, we should think that this pure awareness is something that we cannot objectify. Natorp invents a new term, Bewusstheit, awareity, if you like. Bewusstsein is consciousness, being aware, and Bewusstheit is like some kind of even more abstract state of being aware. Nevertheless, and I think this will become very important for Husserl, as with Kant, Natorp thought of the self as providing a formal function of unifying my experiences. If you remember Kant's answer to Hume, Hume had said that we just have a flow of experiences like actors passing on the stage, but we don't experience ourselves as one of those actors. And Kant's answer was no, but that is because the self, it provides the formal unity of experience. We all know that our experience is mine, it has the capacity of mindness, simply because I identify each of my experiences as my own. That means the I is not an object and cannot be obtained in reflection. But there is, I think Natorp allows, a certain pre-reflective experience of the ego. Now, earlier on in the Logische Untersuchungen, in the first edition, and this is very important because Husserl had two editions of the Logische Untersuchungen, of the logical investigations. First one was 1901 and the second one was 1913. And in between them, he changed his mind. But initially, when he is writing about Natorp's theory of consciousness, Husserl is dismissive of this pure center of relations. He says, I must frankly confess, however, that I am unable to find this primitive necessary center of relations. He says, yes, I can experience the empirical ego, but nothing else. There's nothing underneath this. He's very Humean in the first edition. But by the time he writes the second edition of the Logische Untersuchungen in 1913, which came out at the same time as Ideen Eins, the two works were to show a new turn to transcendental philosophy, Husserl is quite apologetic. He writes in the Ideas, on the question of the pure ego in the logical investigations, I stood for a skepticism that as my studies progressed, I could no longer maintain. And he writes again in another paragraph of the second edition of he added a lot of remarks in the second edition of the logical investigations. And he says, the opposition to the doctrine of a pure ego expressed in this paragraph is one that the author no longer approves of, as is plain from his Ideas. And you see it up there. And then he makes a famous footnote. Husserl did not do a complete revision. He allowed the old text to remain, but he put in some remarks and footnotes. And then, you know, in this previous statement, he said, I am unable to find this primitive necessary center of relations. Now he says, in the last quotation there, I have since managed to find it. I'm now able to find the pure ego. I have learned not to be led astray from the pure grasp of the given through corrupt forms of ego metaphysics. So Husserl now discovers the ego, having been a Brentanian Humean ego skeptic, he now becomes a kind of Kantian ego doctrine of the ego, if you like. And Husserl lays down a number of what he calls essential or eidetic truths. He writes in Ideas 2, which was not published in his lifetime, it was edited by Edith Stein. It pertains in general to the essence of every cogito that a new cogito of the kind called by us ego-reflection is in principle possible. One that grasps on the basis of the earlier cogito the pure subject of that earlier cogito. So in the past, I won't read the rest of that, but previously Husserl had thought that our intentionality was directed outwards to objects, and when we reflected on our intentionality, we could get a new awareness of the object. We could examine what particular side of the object we were thinking about. He now realizes that intentionality is double-sided, and when I reflect on the intentional act, I can also become aware of the new subject. So the pure subject now becomes visible. Moreover, this new subject has to be understood in very different ways. It's not, he says, a box containing, this is a very Humean view, that the ego is not just a box containing lived experiences or a tabula rasa of consciousness upon which things light up and disappear, or a bundle, that was the phrase used in Hume. Rather, the ego that is at issue here can be manifest in every lived experience of wakefulness as a pole, as an ich-pole is the term Husserl uses, as an ich-zentrum, as an I-center. And he thinks about all experiences as either radiating out from the ego or penetrating in towards it. I'll skip some of these. And then he acknowledges explicitly this Kantian idea, and he now embraces it. The pure ego lives itself out in a particular sense in every current, this is occurrent cogito. Yet all background experiences belong to it as well, and it belongs to them. And then in Kantian language, the I think must be able to accompany all my representations. So Husserl really makes a 100% shift from the Humean to the Kantian position. And his subsequent philosophy becomes a very close analysis of the ego. And part of this ego now, he starts to uncover the different layers of the ego. And of course, as I said, most deep in the ego is its consciousness of time. And of course, and Derrida criticizes this, for Husserl, the most immediate consciousness I have is consciousness of the present, of the now. But the now is only known as now if I also have some consciousness of the past. And as he writes, the stream of experience is an endless unity, and the form of the stream is a form necessarily accompanying all experiences of a pure ego. And so Husserl then began his very deep exploration of time consciousness, because he thinks that, and he speaks of this in a way we will find also in Heidegger, of the ego as temporalizing itself, this Zeitigung des Ich, the temporalization of the ego. So let's summarize a little bit what he is saying here. Husserl recognizes now that in our ordinary experience, we don't really have the ego as a real component, he says. Furthermore, the pure ego that we grasp in reflection mustn't be identified with the human personality, if you like. And furthermore, that this pure ego, it's difficult to describe because it's really a pole or center of actions and affections. It is, I think, that to which things are attracted. And I'll just give you here some of the types of language Husserl uses to describe this pure ego. As I said, it's an ich-pole or ich-zentrum. It is the center of all affections and actions. It is the center from which Ausstrahlungen, beams of light or rays of regard stream outwards and in towards which the attention is directed. But it is also a center of my interests. That is a concept that is now being used in discussion of the ethics of animals and so on, that there is a certain degree of requirement to have respect for animals because they have interests. And of course, to be a consciousness is to have a self-interest in survival, in reproduction, in eating. But and on the basis of these interests, we also gain habitualities. And the body becomes the substrate of the body ego, the Ich-Leib, as he talks about it, becomes the substrate of the totality of capacities. And he says, and this is a very important part of what becomes the experience of embodiment in Husserl and later in Merleau-Ponty. This experience of oneself is primarily an experience of free action, of having control over your body, governing or reigning over the body, holding sway. Das waltende Ich in conscious life. So, moreover, and this is very important, because there are some people who think that Husserl is too Cartesian, in that he emphasizes acts of self-thinking and reflecting. But for Husserl, all of my emotions and feelings, capacities and habitus, they all belong also to this ego. In the Cartesian meditations, Husserl talks about how each thing I do remains a permanent mark on my ego. So if I decide to vote for some party, I am permanently the person who decided to do that, even if I later change my mind. I can, as Derrida picks this up, I can even cross out my belief, but it remains there, if you like. It remains always there as something that I did decide at that time. And that leaves Husserl to see that the ego is always evolving and growing. He says this in the Cartesian meditations. The ego constitutes itself, für sich, for itself, so to speak, in the unity of a history. Right? Einheit der Geschichte. So that this is important, that the ego is not to be considered a static point, that's always the same, but it's growing and changing and accruing, as he says, habits and drives. The personal ego constitutes itself not only as a person determined by Triebe, drives, he uses the same word here as Freud, but also as a higher, autonomous, freely acting ego, in particular one guided by rational motives. And Husserl has a very interesting paragraph here that is close to what we now find in this discussion of higher order acts or awareness of one's awareness. The American philosopher Harry Frankfurt has written on the nature of a person, and he regards it to belong to the essence of a human person that they can take as or they can have beliefs about their beliefs. They can have meta representations. It's very important in psychology also. There's a discussion as to whether some animals have this capacity for example, being able to deceive another animal. That means they have to be able to represent that belief and represent what would be to change that belief by themselves having their own belief and showing a different one. It's very, very complicated. But Husserl has the same idea back in the Ideen Zwei, written between 1913 and 1918. He writes about habits. He says, habits are necessarily formed. To yield to a drive establishes the drive to yield habitually. Likewise, to let oneself be determined by a value motive and to resist a drive establishes a tendency to let oneself be determined once again by such a value motive and to resist these drives. And Husserl goes on to talk about the complexity of the layers of the consciousness. For example, he says we can have a more or less unconscious desire to smoke, for example. And I feel in my consciousness this desire to smoke. But I can also think this is a bad habit, I don't want to smoke, I don't want to yield to the drive. Perhaps I still do yield to the drive to smoke, but I can think this is something I value negatively. So I have a whole set of stances towards my own drive. So for Husserl, the truly human being comes about by having these higher order reflective self-awarenesses of my lower order drives. And he thinks that there, you know, he, I suppose, again like Sartre, thinks that there are no drives and instincts that are purely unconscious. They all manifest themselves in consciousness in some way, and then consciousness takes a stance towards them. So I'll skip this. But this, I've just come to the conclusion. Husserl, in the Cartesian meditations and in the crisis, has a lot to say about the nature of the higher transcendental ego that I attain in the epoché. As we saw earlier, it's only through the epoché that I arrive at this ego. But he says much more clearly now in the crisis that actually this new I is only an I by equivocation, though it is an essential equivocation, since when I name it in reflection, I can say nothing other than, this is I who practice the epoché. I who interrogate as phenomenon, the world which is now valid for me, and so on. In other words, Husserl is aware of a very strong paradox, and that is that we feel an identity between the I of the acting natural subject and the transcendental ego. But we cannot identify even more clearly what this identification is. And Husserl has this very complex passage in the crisis that has caused a lot of problems in discussion and interpretation. It's actually a passage that's quoted directly in by Merleau-Ponty in the Phenomenology of Perception, because it leads Merleau-Ponty to this recognition that what Husserl calls primal self-presence, right, this immediate presence to oneself, already includes a certain self-distanciation. Here he writes, and the German isn't any easier, but the English is self-temporalization through depresentation, Entgegenwärtigung, and a depresencing, so to speak, through recollection, has its analog in my alienation of self, Selbstentfremdung. And then he goes on to say that empathy, that is a relation to others, is a depresentation of a higher level, depresentation of my Urpräsenz into a merely vergegenwärtige primal presence, presentified. Thus, in me, another I achieves its validity as co-present. Now, that's a very complicated idea. But Husserl here, and many other places in his writings, makes a parallel between my experience of others, which is always that I am positing another ego in my own self-experience, and therefore I have to posit a new center of relations other than myself, and he puzzles about how this is possible, but he bases it on a similarity with what I do in self-reflection, in memory. When I recall an earlier state of myself, I have to identify the ego of now with the ego of that past. And that means I make a kind of self-presencing, but also a self-alienation. And it's this double capacity which is central to what he will later talk about, splitting of the ego, this Ich-Spaltung. I split my ego in memory, and I therefore am able to take a certain kind of distance towards myself. But at the same time, when I'm remembering me as a child, I'm also identifying with this earlier self. So there's this double capacity of identity and difference that we are doing all the time. And for Husserl, that's the basis of what he will talk the constitution of other egos. So he writes in the Formal and Transcendental Logic, the problem is to understand how my transcendental ego, the Urgrund, the primitive basis for everything that I accept as existent, can constitute within itself another transcendental ego, and then too an open plurality of other egos. other egos absolutely inaccessible to my ego in their original being, and yet recognizable as existing and as being thus and so. So this is the problem. And he says that I do this through some kind of awareness that is similar to knowing myself in the past. There's a peculiar temporalization, this is the Zeitigung of the ego. In the last bit there in bold, the ego which is present now, thus temporalized, has contact with his past ego, even though the latter is no longer present. It can have a dialogue with it and criticize it, and can others. So my self-awareness, my Selbsterfahrung, is also the basis for my Fremderfahrung. And this, I will stop here. This will lead Husserl to a broader analysis, which becomes the basis of his understanding of this Wir Gemeinschaft, of this we community, that in our social relations, we take stances towards each other, not just as egos, but as persons that participate in what he calls die personalistische Einstellung, the personalistic attitude, which, as he says here, is the attitude we are always in when we talk to one another, shake hands with one another in greeting, or are related to one another in love and aversion, in disposition and action, in discourse and discussion. So Husserl thinks that in order to have a recognition of others as persons, we must have a huge amount of self-knowledge, so that the life in community, for Husserl, is based upon reflection on one's personal existence. So I leave you with this final quotation. I am, and everyone else is, in the horizon of the we. And this horizon is at the same time the horizon for many communities, and for all of those to whom I in particular belong, and to which each person belongs. And over and above this is a further extension to what he calls uneigentlichen Gemeinschaften, inauthentic communities as communal possession and of remote effects of persons on persons, effects standing out. Here he's talking about our involvement with history. So that, and I taught a little bit about this yesterday, Husserl believes that in a life in tradition, I can be in dialogue with Plato, even though Plato no longer exists, because I have a personal recognition of the kinds of motivations that Plato was interested in, and these two are identified as my motivations. And so I live in a wider horizon of the we, as he says. So I wanted to show you in this talk, not just that really everything in Husserl is about this Selbstauslegung des Ego, the self-explication of the ego, but also this comes the basis for his understanding of a mutual understanding and dialogue, the kinds of things that one finds in Gadamer, for example, in Truth and Method, are very heavily drawn from these late manuscripts of Husserl, especially in The Crisis, and Gadamer himself recognized that. So Husserl is a Cartesian thinker, but he is also a thinker of otherness and difference. Okay, thank you very much.